Well, thank you very much for that that very cheerful introduction, Robert. All I can say is my subject today may, on the conversations we've been having about former colleagues, we know we at least can identify one or two of our Adelaide residents and friends of ours for whom salinity of the water supply is not a problem, as they have found other means of liquid injection that will keep them permanently avoiding drinking Adelaide's water supplies, whether they're a problem or not. But I do appreciate this invitation here to talk to the press club. I've always found press clubs in the different states very appropriate forums when you want to discuss serious policy issues, and particularly when you want to make a few policy announcements. And we have, for some time now, been operating a group of our front bench, chaired by Nick Bolkus and Bob McMullen, including all our senior shadow ministers, dealing with a number of environmental problems. And we now have from them a series of policies, some of which we will announce in the period prior to the next election, and others of which, of course, we'll wait for that occasion. And that has been part of a process that we've had in place since the beginning of this year to have virtually all the policy we need ready for the next poll by the time our federal conference comes round, so that some of that can be released during the course of the federal conference, and we use that as a springboard to for shifting the political debate in this country, which has been too narrow for too long and too off focus for an agenda for a genuine nation confronting serious problems, but with the capacities to deal with them if only the politicians will focus. So what I'm talking about today is preserving our environment, a key part of our policies for the next election. We often talk about the environment as if it were just another policy agenda item. But of course the care and protection of our natural surroundings means more than this. Our love of this beautiful country unites us all, farmers, city dwellers, young and old. Whether it's the Adelaide Hills or our endless beaches or the vast Australian skies or the colours of the desert, we know the great blessing of living in such a country. And we know how important it is to preserve this heritage and to hand it on to our kids. We've done much to change this country since European settlement. Strangers in a strange land, confronted by an alien landscape and exotic creatures, sought to, as they saw it, tame it. Our pioneer ancestors built townscapes based on their beloved birthplaces and more suitable for European climates. Crops and creatures from other places were brought in to be farmed with practices unsuitable for this landscape. A small population in a seemingly endless country of limitless bounty saw little need to develop skills to conserve, protect or preserve resources. Similarly, it was unthinkable that relatively few people in such a vast landscape would ever need to address in a serious way the consequences of poor waste management or poor use of the environment. As a result today, we find that we are confronted with a myriad of complex and interconnected challenges. Declining land productivity, poor water, reduced air quality, plant and animal species dying out, and a range of environmentally related health issues. Many irrational outcomes in Australia's environment have been driven by rational goals. Starting with economic survival, these goals progress to economic growth and the attainment of economic prosperity. The fact is that some of the practices employed in pursuing these goals were then and still are unsuited to our environment and unsustainable. Consumers, primary and secondary producers, service industries, researchers and governments all have a role to play in seeking and implementing solutions. This should be readily understood in South Australia. You are placed both symbolically and geographically as the end result of the failure thus far to deal with the complex and interrelated problems of land and water use in the Murray-Darling Basin. In this driest state, in the driest continent on earth, water has always been of paramount importance. The problems are not generated in South Australia alone, nor can they be solved here in isolation. You find yourselves at the rough end of a national and systemic crisis. A key aspect of that crisis in the Murray-Darling Basin and across the nations generally is land degradation and the consequent problems of rising levels of salinity. The challenge posed by the degradation of our land demands an urgent response and deep commitment from the nation's leaders. Already, land degradation is costing communities billions of dollars each year, risking the future of many of our rural and regional communities. Australia needs a natural resource management process that will be sustained over time. Labor supports a national approach to addressing salinity, one that is, to the extent this is ever possible in my business, above the ruck of day-to-day party politics. Of course, Labor cannot and will not support a solution based on one of the most divisive issues in our community, that is the sale of Telstra. If the present government chooses to base its response to land degradation on the sale of a government stake, as it is often hinted, we will not support that. We don't believe rural and regional communities should be told the salinity problem can be fixed, but only if telecommunications services are slashed. Yet this is effectively what the government is saying. If all government ownership in Telstra goes, there is no way a government can ensure its far-flung communities will be treated fairly. Already, rural and regional Australia is way behind in the provision of telephone and related services, with a future for many businesses lying in connection to online services such as internet. The sale of Telstra would mean an even greater disconnect in the lives of non-city dwellers. Regional communities continue to play a significant role in maintaining and enriching the social, economic and environmental fabric of a nation. The same communities are bearing the brunt of some of the most pressing environmental challenges that face our nation at a time of significant local change. Although substantial opportunities exist for growth and prosperity in the agricultural and resource-based industries, there will also be significant physical restrictions to growth unless these resource challenges are met. Increasing demands on water resources and increases in the extent and severity of land and water degradation must be addressed. And nowhere is this better understood than here in South Australia. And let me say that particular credit in this instance should also go to the Advertiser, who I note have been supporting the community awareness campaign, ensuring South Australians are fully informed and involved in the campaign to save the Murray. To address these environmental and regional development issues effectively, a sustained national effort is required from all sectors of the community and industry, with national leadership from the Commonwealth and coordinated action amongst the states. And yet the government seems hell-bent on avoiding a national approach to most issues. Labor federal governments have always operated in partnership with state, territory and local governments, especially on important national issues like the environment. In government, we found the best way to do that was through meetings of the heads of all Australian governments through the Council of Australian Governments, commonly known as COAG. Currently, the COAG meets less often than the European Council. Understand this, COAG meets less often than the European Council. German heads of government, and they have a similar federal system to us, meet every 2 or 3 months. But our COAG meets at the whim of the Prime Minister on an ad hoc basis. And in fact, in November, we'll be having only its fourth ever meeting under this government. Under John Howard, this important forum for cooperative national policies has become virtually irrelevant. Our economic health and environmental well-being cannot be separated. Treated apart, we are bound to fail both causes. But treated together, we can have a chance of succeeding. Sustainable resource management is not about constraining rural communities and those producing our agricultural wealth. It is about guaranteeing the sustainability of agricultural activities and the long-term viability of the communities that depend on our natural resources for their livelihoods. Sustainability is not an optional extra. It must be the starting point for all that we do. We have a chance to repair the damage sustained over 2 centuries and to provide a flourishing natural Australian environment with a strong economic basis and thriving regional communities. A healthy and sustainable environment will improve living standards, create jobs, encourage growth of sustainable industries. Sustainable development represents the future for regional Australia. With regional delivery of natural resource management, sustainable agricultural practices and new opportunities. Already business leaders, landholders and communities are recognising the opportunities that improved natural resource management represents. Innovative farmers are implementing water efficiency measures that are dramatically reducing the amount of water required for a crop. Industry associations are working with their membership to help them improve. At a state government level, a number of initiatives are also underway, from assessment of biodiversity and salinity credits to constructive dialogue in environmental flows in both the Murray and Snowy Rivers. For all this good work, the problem of land degradation remains. Recent research has estimated the degradation of our rural landscapes is costing regional communities in the order of $2 billion per annum. This is expected to blow out to some $6 billion by 2020 in the absence of action to address it. In my home state of Western Australia, 1.8 million hectares are currently salt affected, an area that is expected to double by 2020. Here in South Australia, all agricultural districts exhibit some degree of salinity, and at least 20% of all surface water is above recommended salinity levels limits for human consumption. A recent salinity audit has found that within 20 years, Adelaide's major supply of drinking water, the Murray, will not pass World Health Organisation standards on 2 days out of every five. In New South Wales, as much as 7.5 million hectares could be affected by rising groundwaters. The practices of the past have resulted in the problems we now face. Continued land clearing and inappropriate agricultural practices are continuing to exacerbate the problem. While today's landholders are more environmentally conscious than ever before, and in many areas they are leading the world in environmental management, the status quo is not sustainable. The cost of addressing the issue now and halting further decline will be less than the cost of rehabilitation later. During Labor's last period in office, institutions were set up to provide the framework for action, including the Murray-Darling Basin Commission, the Ministerial Council and the Community Advisory Committee. The Council of Australian Government's water policy reform agenda was adopted. A national environmental sustainable development strategy was agreed. Labor established the Decade of Land Care, the 1 Billion Trees Program, the National Water Quality Management Strategy, the National Forest Policy, the Water Watch Program and the Murray-Darling Cap. Well, what has this government done? The Prime Minister set up a high-level ministerial task force on salinity earlier this year with Ministers Anderson, Truss, Costello and Hill. Yet it missed its first deadline to report to the Prime Minister in May, and the excuse given by Mr Truss was that they were all too busy. You've got four of the busiest ministers, trying to get them all together in one room makes life hard. It makes you wonder how high a priority the government has given this vital issue. I might say I've had about 9 of my most senior front benchers meeting on this. They manage to get together every 2 or 3 weeks. I know the workload differences are substantial, but nevertheless, intelligent people can usually find time for a bit of sitting down and getting on with it. The draft salinity management strategy was due to be completed by June 2000, yet has been delayed at least until August. Even the $1.25 billion National Heritage Trust has come at the expense of core funding on the environment. It has camouflaged a 40% reduction in core Commonwealth spending on the environment since the Howard government came to power. Many of the programs funded under the Trust were established under Labor and now rely almost entirely on an NHT for their existence. Without a renewed commitment, these programs will cease in 2002 when the NHT runs out. I want to quote from the government's own mid-term reviews of the NHT. "Very few participants believe the NHT has had much success," and "the on-ground works may not be cost-effective," and "may not lead to the changes that will be needed to deal with dryland salinity," unquote. The NHT has failed the communities who are working so hard to restore and protect the environment. It has been an expensive, wasted opportunity at a time when real action was desperately needed. The Prime Minister's Science and Engineering Innovation Council recognised the urgency and magnitude of dryland salinity when it reported to the Prime Minister more than 18 months ago. The report's first recommendation was for the Prime Minister to make a statement acknowledging the seriousness of the problem and supporting activities to address it. Yet a year and a half later, the Prime Minister has still not responded to this call from his own advisers. In addition to public recognition from the top, the report also called for comprehensive analysis to identify those areas which would benefit from public and private investment and a shift in focus from treatment of symptoms to treatment of causes. It recommended that land clearing only be allowed after a thorough analysis of regional water balances to ensure that new land uses will not exacerbate future dry land salinity problems. The report highlighted the need for further research in farming systems and land use systems suitable for Australia and the need for ongoing funding of research planning and on-ground works. It recommended regulatory and market-based instruments, including salinity and carbon credits, be used to influence the ability to address dry land salinity, and that current initiatives at state level should be assessed for national implementation. The Council's report provided an important contribution to the debate about the state of land degradation and dry land salinity in Australia, but more importantly, it provided some first steps of how to set about meeting the challenge. The report will guide Labor's approach when in government. The sheer scale of the problem clearly requires a national response. No state is immune from the effects of land and water degradation, and all are affected by the actions of others. High-level political involvement underpinning a national approach is essential for achieving solutions and to ensure that decisions made are binding on all jurisdictions. These issues require urgent attention by all levels of government at the highest levels. What we need is heads of government coming together and applying a whole-of-government approach. Although significant progress has been made since the formation of the Murray-Darling Basin Ministerial Council in 1985, there is general acceptance that the current arrangements are not as effective as they could and should be. Today I want to take this opportunity to announce that in office Labor will establish a national strategy to combat salinity, as indeed the Prime Minister's task force recommends. We'll set in place a national framework of objectives, targets and priorities for natural resource management, as indeed that committee has recommended the Commonwealth should do. The development of a full set of indicators and targets will be given priority, and we will work with states and regions to ensure they are consistent between the different levels. Where regulations differ between states, we will work with states to develop national standards and to streamline regulation between the states and between states and the Commonwealth. This national framework will include clearly defined roles and responsibilities of the various tiers of government, and will set in place a framework for regional priorities for natural resource management. Clear roles, responsibilities and targets will help prevent the significant cost shifting that has occurred under the National Heritage Trust programs. We recognise that setting targets will be no easy task. Sustainability indicators are largely untested. But we'll not use that as an excuse for inaction. We will set targets, but we'll make sure that there is a feedback mechanism in place for ongoing review and refinement of targets. These targets will be supported by action plans and an effective monitoring system to ensure performance can be measured and tracked. It is essential the government has the ability to enforce the national strategy through a cooperative but enforceable partnership with various parties. They will therefore link funding of state and regional activities to environmental outcomes and will withhold that funding where those outcomes are not met. Funding will not be merely allocated on a project-by-project basis like the NHT, but will be allocated according to regional priorities and consistent with the national strategy. I really do feel that the fundamental fault at the end of the day with the NHT, apart from some of the misleading advertising associated with what it was actually doing, is it fell between the stools of serious environmental policy and political pork barrelling. Frankly, if you divide any of these programs up for political pork barrelling, you are dead. And that's the end of it. And that is what has been occurring in this particular case. Where possible, Labor will pursue market-based mechanisms. Market-based solutions allow flexible responses that provide individual choice. They provide a stimulus for cost-effective innovation and faster progress. Labor in New South Wales has led the way in the consideration of market-based mechanisms, including looking at tradable permits or credits for salt, biodiversity and carbon. We will explore opportunities for the extension of this approach into other states and regions. I do commend the Labor government in New South Wales for its initiative, but I think if you sit down and think through this thing logically, unless it's tradable on a national basis, they will be very difficult schemes to put in place. Though somebody had to start it, and it's an excellent thing that Bob Carr chose to be the person who would. What this means in effect is that we will create a demand for good land management, rather than merely trying to stop harmful practices. A federal Labor government will offer to assist New South Wales and other states in piloting market-based programs. We'll cooperate with the states to explore options for a federal legislative framework to support such programs at a national level by defining appropriate property rights and trading mechanisms. We recognise that market-based approaches also require access to reliable market information. One market-based approach designed to recognise leadership and encourage innovation is the concept of endorsement labelling and codes of practice. Labor will work with industry and landholders over time to develop resource management benchmarks and codes of practice that allow responsible resource management to be recognised and differentiated in the marketplace. The CSIRO has already started looking into the concept of a star rating scheme to rate resource management practices. Labor will assess the opportunities for such a scheme to promote best practice. Taxation measures have also been effective in the past in providing incentives for behavioural change in natural resource management. It was only as late as 1983 that tax incentives were finally removed for land clearing, and it took a Labor government to do it. Labor would support further investigation of the effectiveness of these and related measures in accelerating the uptake of new agricultural systems and sustainable agricultural practices. The increase in salinity is a blight on our countryside. It is critical that the issue is not left to sporadic meetings, but driven centrally within the core of government. Responsibility for resource and environmental policy and management is currently spread across portfolios. In government, we will therefore establish a new Office of Sustainable Development in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to oversee general issues of sustainability, embracing ecological, economic and social dimensions. This office would provide a more cohesive, coordinated and proactive national effort on issues of environment and sustainability. This office would also have responsibility for the environmental review of legislation as part of the process of coordinating comments for Cabinet submissions. Salinity and natural resource management will be a key priority for this new office. With the Prime Minister's own department having a critical role, this policy priority will get the national recognition it demands. Driven by this new office and under the auspices of the Council of Australian Governments, the new strategy will bring together all levels of government, landholders, agricultural industries, regional communities, interest groups and catchment management bodies. Given these issues, it is encouraging to hear that the Howard government intends to make the Murray the top of the agenda for the next COAG meeting in November. As I said earlier, I note that this is one of the rare COAG meetings under the Howard government, a very disappointing track record, given how imperative it is to have a national approach to issues like this one. A Labor government will have the political will to drive the COAG reform agenda. Issues that must be addressed under this framework must include a nationally endorsed natural resource management strategy with targets and caps, the need for an action plan to deliver against those targets and caps, the respective roles and responsibilities of the states and federal government, reform of the Murray-Darling Basin Commission, including its membership, its powers and its responsibilities, the progress of the COAG water reform process, commitment of resources on a shared basis with stakeholders. Under the COAG umbrella, and in the context of the national strategy, we will convene a special meeting of the East Coast State Premiers together with South Australia to address the specific issues of the Murray-Darling Basin. One of the issues the meeting will need to address is the reform of the Murray-Darling Basin Commission. More by tradition than requirement, The Commission has been composed of senior bureaucrats appointed by each jurisdiction. It has not been an expert commission or a skills-based commission, and as a result has tended to shadow the political debate and to second-guess the political direction of the Ministerial Council. The Commission could be more effective through a more skills-based membership. The capacity to negotiate enforceable performance agreements, the ability to respond in a more timely and decisive manner, and an enhanced capacity to commission, oversee, publish and act on research. I've talked about the role of governments, but I would like to acknowledge the significant role that communities already play in addressing issues of land degradation. The Commonwealth Government cannot solve these major environmental problems in isolation. They need the help of state and local governments and industry, but most of all, they need the support of communities and the private sector. Labor will enable communities to participate in the debate and to be part of the solution. We are committed to getting people involved in the processes that develop the policies to change their lives. We want to send the strongest possible signal to groups working on sustainable and integrated solutions that Labor is prepared to facilitate constructive outcomes. And we will promote the concept of corporate responsibility and encourage the private sector to be more involved in determining solutions and developing infrastructure. It has been especially good to be here in South Australia today to talk about this issue. There is a great opportunity for this state to become a world leader in salinity control and natural resource management. At the Wake campus of the University of Adelaide, for instance, the state already has the National Centre for Excellence in Agricultural Research with close links to the CSIRO. We have to build on those strengths. Boosting the state's overall knowledge capacity will be the first building block in our plans to build a better future for South Australia. Our aim will be to make South Australia a world leader in environmental research and development, with a proud part to play in Labor's vision for Australia as the knowledge nation. No one should imagine that this is a task for the short term, any more than they should imagine that governments and dollars are alone of the solution. Success requires a sustained national effort from all sectors of the community and industry. Success requires national leadership from the federal government. Success requires a national strategy, and that is what I'm proposing to deliver. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim. It's now time for questions. And we'll follow our normal policy of letting the lead questions be addressed by media members of the club. Have I a question?
Mr. Beasley, your Greg speech was good, and the intermittent behavioural changes that you're suggesting are also good, but you must accept perhaps a little bit of responsibility for this not happening now. You've been travelling around Australia, you've seen that, generally speaking, all Australians are reasonably doing reasonably well physically. This is our only century in which people, poor people, are fat people. And this means that physically we are doing well. But what are you, and this is my question, what will you do to bring mental well-being to Australia? And perhaps you could take a leaf from President Mbeki in South Africa, who during the recent AIDS conference invited dissenters to his forum, much to the protest of the dogmatists.
Could you name this?
Frederick Turbin, Adelaide Institute.
Mm. Well, Fred, if you don't mind my saying, this question's a bit off the wall. On the on the subject of fat people in this country, I'm making my own contribution to becoming a thinner person. And I can recommend an excellent course of climbing up around Aisley every morning if you're mad enough to do it. On the mental well-being of people, I think that is a separate set of issues, and in the category of health policy, we'd be pretty pleased to address them. I think that the issues of depression in our society are issues that have to be addressed and are intimately bound up with dealing with what is a great national scourge, particularly amongst young and middle-aged men, of suicide. And we do have a policy approaches to those issues, and I'm pleased to say the government is itself seized with their concerns in that regard. But if you don't mind my saying, while I don't mind handling questions in other areas, I think there probably will be a few questions here on the issues directly related to the paper, and perhaps I ought to listen to one or two of them.
Kim, Roy Eccleston from the paper. In regard to the policies, you don't say how you're going to pay for them. You talk about how you won't pay for them with the Telstra sale, but what breaks do you have in mind?
Well, Roy, this applies to every policy that we announce in the course between now and the next election. What we're trying to do here is to shift the ground of the debate. I do notice in one of the papers today it said that we had a particular policy option that we'd announced at National Conference. We were going to throw billions of dollars at it. Let me tell you this, I'm not going to throw billions of dollars at anything. We are going to properly plan and target a build-up of expenditure in policies of all the areas of national investment that we identify. And we are, of course, in that process, when we're thinking of the first three-year cut of it, awaiting the next budget, frankly, to see what the government's own projections on the out years are before we make our final determinations on where we may make savings and where we may expend on this and other areas of concern to us. I've got to say too, in this area, one of the lessons that we take out of the report to the Prime Minister is that we are a long way short at the moment of arriving at what the strategies in practical terms need to be. We have arrived at the identification of the problem in the broad. We have not arrived specifically at the way in which we should devise caps, the way in which we should be responding with things like the credit system I've been talking about, the first steps that need to be taken by governments and the resources that need to be attached to those steps. We are short of the beginning of a sensible spending program. And one of the lessons that I take from the Heritage Trust is we are not going to pick up $1 billion and dump it down again, because we have just had $1 billion worth of near complete failure. That is a tragedy. Now, I understand why it was made. Political parties do from time to time like to see the opportunity. And I have to say, and historically, the Labor Party is not immune from this practice of identifying a problem and then alleging that they have a solution when, in fact, what is being run is a political game. I think what we're proposing here is to put in place the structures to kill that, to put in place the structures that will mean that you'll not be able to get away with it, because the level of scrutiny and transparency will be too great and the forward projections of the program too well embraced. Suffice it to say, therefore, I think that before this costs substantial sums of money, and it ultimately may well do so, there is a period of time in which the processes have to be put properly in place, an understanding developed of what will be there, borne by the community, if you like, or borne in the marketplace, an understanding of the quite right balance between tax breaks and direct expenditures, the responsibilities the states outline. We are in a situation of emergency, but not of emergency which requires wandering around the place firing off dollars in the first 12 months. That is not what is the situation that is before us here. So we are going to arrive at affordable strategies that will ensure that in this area, as in many others, we have an appropriate level of start-up that doesn't break the bank in the course of the first 3 years of operation of the Labor government. Now, when other people raise questions who are far less erudite than you about issues like the where the money's coming from issue, I always say nice try. The sensible thing, of course, for any opposition is to wait till all information is in, and to wait, as Peter Costello said so delicately before the 96 election in a phrase that I quite enjoy, we are in the clutches of an election campaign. And you'll see plenty of it then. But suffice it to say, I'm not of the view that at least in its start-up years, given the initial task that is before us, that it will be difficult at all to set this strategy in place fiscally in the first few years of a Labor government.
Could I try and sneak in another quick one? Sorry about that. We had a front page story the other day saying that next week you're going to be told by senior Labor figures to pick up your game, lift your game. Can you give us an assessment of what you think your game is at the moment?
Well, our game is getting a policy together in a coherent fashion, putting it before the Australian people. And frankly, I think we've done pretty well at it. You know, here we are, with all of the warts and all that comes with the process of campaigning, the accidents that trip you up on the way. If you take a look at where we are now, in a period of great prosperity in this country, long-sustained prosperity, indeed 4 or 5 years of it, 4 or 5 years of it before this government came into place, we are, with all our errors, in every poll I've seen, contestable as far as the election is concerned. And frankly, an opposition who ought to be well behind, that is a pretty good outcome. Now you might like well ask the question of the government, why are they in that situation? I'll give them an answer. And that is because the agenda on which they have operated is narrow and backward looking and remains narrow and backward looking. And one of the things I'm proud of over the last few months is that I now find wherever I go people demanding of me that I state exactly what we mean by Knowledge Nation, exactly, you know, what we mean by our health programs. What does that mean? It means that we're doing the first thing that an opposition needs to do before final cuts of policy are released, and that is to set the agenda. So after a few years now in which the agenda has been set by others and we have been obliged to respond to it, we are now setting it. Now that's what I call leadership from opposition, and this step today is just another part of it.
Mr. Beasley, Jeremy Boylan from the ABC. It seems one of the biggest problems associated with issues is overcoming the squabbling among the states. We've got South Australia threatening to sue upstream users. How do you gain the cooperation of those states, and is the key measure you're proposing in your speech today to withhold funding to them?
Firstly, I think we have to set targets and we have to get an agreement on measurements of achievement in regard to those targets. But if funding is coming forward from the federal government, then I think the federal government is entitled to expect conformity and compliance with those targets. And if they are not achieved, of course, then to use the option of withholding, which creates a political environment in which the state government has to answer, or any other level of government has to answer to a constituency for where it has managed to take affairs. So I do think that there has to be total consultation, but there also has to be outcomes. And the Commonwealth is standing back from a squabble, and it's also standing back from state governments when they try to tackle a problem. The biggest problem that we have at the moment, as I think everyone would acknowledge with land clearances in Queensland, the Beattie government has made an effort to address that. When it made an effort to address that and started to run into trouble with rural groups, the response of the Commonwealth government was not to be helpful, but to have questions fed it and Dorothy Dix's in question time, where it could mock the Beattie government. Now, that is a government actually trying to do something. Currently, the Commonwealth and the states are running spoiler roles on each other. It can't do that. And that is why I think you've got to set up a formal structure, a COAG process, and we would have, I think we've announced this before in terms of other policy areas, we would have COAG meeting routinely, at least several times a year, to be the political directional body for others with expertise, in this case it would be the Murray-Darling Basin Commission, and you'd have the states owning the process along with the local communities, along with the Commonwealth Government. That won't resolve squabbling, but it'll put a milieu in which squabbling gets resolved. At the moment now, I think it's almost suiting the political interests of the various states to point fingers at each other and the Commonwealth to point fingers at the states, and that there is political kudos to be obtained from being able to do that. Well, there is political kudos to be obtained, but no solutions. And this process will end that.
Hugh Morgan from the Advertiser. What is your personal position, and also on a federal level, the ALP's position, on the co-location of intermediate or high-level radioactive waste at a planned low-level repository in South Australia?
Well, I think the first thing that we would do on that is I understand that there's a secret agreement that was arrived at between the Olson government and Nick Minchin, or the Commonwealth government, on co-location of low-level waste and medium-level waste, and that the agreement is of the nature that if you have the low-level waste area facility, that you are first cab off the rank, or some effective process like that, first cab off the rank for the middle-level committee. Well, firstly, the first thing I do about that is end that. There'd be no relationship between the two, as far as we are concerned. No relationship at all. The second thing is, this has come on at a pace has been largely determined by another policy decision of this government that we don't agree with, and that is the location of the replacement reactor at Lucas Heights. We don't agree with that. We don't think that that should occur. We don't think the replacement reactor should be at Lucas Heights. We think that there should be, as has been recommended to the government by various inquiries reported a year or so ago, before there is any acquisition of a reactor, an inquiry to work out a different location, and also to have as a term of reference a question of whether or not there should be one at all. Now, the pace at which decisions are being brought on in relation to where the dumping facility should be has been largely determined by a desire to get that other issue resolved. And we think, and currently at least, the contractual arrangements are such that we can put that on slowdown until there have been proper environmental studies done and a proper inquiry done. Whether that will still be the case 12 months from now is another matter, but it would be the case now, and our recommendation to the government, and I notice just from the media, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not they've appropriately tendered this. They've arrived at an outcome within the cost constraints that they put in place. There are all sorts of issues that they are now grappling with internally that may well delay completion of this process, and that would be all to the good. Whenever, and at some point of time in the future, there will have to be an addressing of what is to be done by Australian generated waste. We think that when that occurs, and for the reasons I've already outlined, we don't think that actually needs to be done now, but we think that when that occurs, then a judgment should be made independent of where current low-level waste or where low-level waste facilities are established. Independent of that, it should of course be a scientific and environmental study, but it should also have within its frame of reference the view that South Australia is already bearing a preponderant burden of the nuclear clean-up via Maralinga, and that it is a reasonable thing in those circumstances to pay attention to the views that are there in the South Australian legislature and of the South Australian people. Now, this thing has been brought on far more quickly than indeed have been the case, and it has been brought on under a criteria which we don't see as necessarily applying at all.
G'day, Kim. My name is Daniel Keane. I'm from the Pipeline at Semaphore in Adelaide. I was curious, why don't, if you're saying that, unlike in the papers, that you're not going to spend billions and you're going to spend appropriate money on salinity, but what about doing what the Middle Eastern countries do? I'm not sure if you're aware of it, whereby they've got all the oceans close to them, like we have here in Adelaide and right around Australia, and just take the salt water out, not the salt water, but the salt out of the salt water and use that to for drinking water. Is that an option or not?
It is an option, but it produces a bottle of water more expensive than a bottle of champagne. You're quite right, some Middle Eastern countries do that. I don't think, at least in current technologies, that that is a long-term answer or a substantial answer to Australian water problems. I think that we can deal with our water problems by fixing up our internal systems, and that is the challenge that I'm talking about here today.
Is that working? Belinda Huppertz from The Advertiser. I just wanted to ask you to expand on your comments about the Murray-Darling Basin Commission. You mentioned that a Labor government would look at revamping the commission. Can you tell me more about the concerns you have with the makeup of it at the moment?
Well, it is a commission of public servants, basically all of them second-guessing their ministers, or not second-guessing their ministers, but presenting ministerial positions. It's not to say it doesn't do useful work. It does do useful work. But and of course, this is something that we'd need to talk through with the states, as I indicated in my propositions here. But we would look at it instead more in the context of a statutory authority, and that there would be it would have substantial powers, as I outlined here, for effectively the day-to-day management of the programs that were agreed between the government, the states, local authorities and the communities, and the management of the standards and targets that were put in place. But it would need to be a body of people of expertise. Obviously, you'd be looking at local community representatives so that their views were clearly understood. But we do have, actually you have here in South Australia, some people with very substantial expertise in the critical issues that would have to be considered by such a body. And they would need to be the people who would become representative on it. So it would the if you have COAG properly functioning, and COAG is of course serviced by the relevant departments to the particular ministers who attend COAG, if you have COAG properly functioning, that is where the politics, if you like, can be managed, massaged and allayed. Instead of on the commission itself, which needs to be focused on the actual issue as opposed to the interstate and state-commonwealth relationship. So, in fact, the commission would completely change its character on that basis.
Formerly the ABC and News Limited, an economics question, Kim. Protesters at Seattle labelled globalisation as the absolute curse of civilisation. In view of the multiplicity of firms taking all their manufacturing activities out of Australia, are you increasingly coming to the conclusion that globalisation, like the seven plagues of Egypt, has become far more a curse, a curse, a curse than any blessing to our civilisation, if it's...
Well, one thing I know about globalisation is that we in Australia don't have choices as to whether or not we're part of it. Globalisation has been given the attributes of policy, and when in fact it is it requires policy responses, and that because we live in an international community, a global community, which is, and the globalism is basically technology-driven, not policy-driven. It is sometimes thought that states don't have choices in the way in which we negotiate terms and conditions of our relationship to the rest of the international community. We don't have a choice about being part of that international community. As I said, it is technologically driven before it is driven by any policy forces. In far as our over-dependence upon foreign capital is concerned, that is a serious problem. It is partly induced by a problem of generating domestic capital to do the things that we need to do in this country, which has in substantial degree and is being resolved by what is being done by what is effectively compulsory investment in superannuation funds. And that we've gone from something like $40 billion to over when we came into office to over $300 billion when we left, now, of Australian-generated capital in Australian funds. I think one of the challenges for government is how we put in place the tax regime and the incentives that make it more interesting for people to invest in knowledge and businesses here. To deal directly with one aspect of your question, we invent 3% of the world's new knowledge in Australia and about 1% of the world's new product. In Israel, the figure is about 0.5% of the world's new knowledge and about 8% of the world's new product. And one of the things that we contributed, for example, in the business tax deliberations that the government had, there's more to just the than just the GST and taxation discussions, was a suggestion that they ought to be restoring the 150% R&D concession, which was critical to Australian manufacturing industry. And the R&D concession was used by Australian manufacturing industry to invest in new product and new processes that kept Australian manufacturing industry current. And that was baby out with the bathwater when that particular concession disappeared. We also think it's legitimate for governments, when they're making decisions themselves about their own acquisitions or giving off approvals for other people to do things in this country, to require of them a statement on what they intend to do locally and source locally to ensure that what they do is provide jobs here, as opposed to necessarily using Australian savings or Australian resources to create jobs elsewhere. There's a whole range of things that governments can do to deal with how we participate in the global economy. What we cannot do is take a decision not to participate in the global economy. There is no choice as far as that is concerned. As I said, it is driven by technology. It is not driven simply by decisions of governments. But what governments need to do is not stand helpless in the face of it, but they have options open to them that can materially advance the interests of their own people so that their own people benefit substantially from what the opportunities there are out there, and at the same time protect themselves against some of the damage that that might be done by participation in a global system.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I've answered it very directly, I thought. Oh, is it a curse or a blessing? I think I answered it as an inevitability.
Just a quick question at the end. On your market-oriented approach to reducing the problems of salinity, could you expand a little bit on the role of the consumer? Do you support a system of labelling which, in effect, would give a salt-friendly star system to products, thereby penalising those companies which actually are not salt-friendly or increasing the problems of salinity?
Well, I think that was the sort of thing that I was talking about in my remarks, in both endorsements and the star system. I think there's a lot to labelling. I think there is now more and more in our economy, and it's not just an Australian phenomenon, an intelligent consumer who is making decisions all the time on what they see about what is important to them in the environment and in terms of Australian national production and all the rest of the whole range of things. And I think that labelling is a very important way of encouraging environmental good practice. And it's not just here, of course, in the areas I've been talking about, but in other areas as well. But nevertheless, I think there is an awful lot of product that comes out of areas that are under threat, and if good practice can be rewarded, then it should be. And one of the good ways of rewarding good practice is to ensure that the product of good practice has a marketing advantage over the product of those who are indifferent. And so I think it's a useful additive to a range of things that that might be out there in the marketplace to assist the processes that we've been talking about.
Kim, just a last question that's from me. Quick double barrel one, but it's a sun-off double barrel one. One, what do you think of the what do you think of the chances of a earlier federal election rather than a late one? And two, in government, would you give birth to another two Collins-class submarines?
Well, firstly, on a double-barreled, you know, for a sawn-off shotgun, that's usually for close-in work, and I notice the distance you're standing from me. That's too long reading American detective novels. But the early federal election, of course, is in Mr Howard's gift. For an earlier federal election to take place would simply be an outrage. And basically, the terms of parliament are too short. We ought to be having, and I've said it before, 4-year parliaments. I think it's one of the range of issues that we no longer seem to address in this country. That is our constitution. I think that that we ought to be getting to a situation where governments do not operate at a gallop but give considered views to all the problems they handle, and therefore they should at least serve out their full terms. So it's in Mr Howard's hands. Mr Howard's problem is this: he's got nothing more on his agenda. That leaves him in a that leaves him at substantial risk if he hangs around for another 12 months. And he's now trying to devise ideas, invent a few ideas, but he actually has nothing more to say to the Australian political process, and on the basis of nothing more to say, he's effectively going to ask for another 3 years in office. So that may well impel him to think about things that a bit earlier. On the Collins-class submarine, I was very pleased to see Mr Moore say the other day, reported in one of the august columns, I think, of the Advertiser, saying that that after problems in the submarine are fixed, we'll go to a seventh submarine. That was attributed to him. I think that the problems do have to be fixed first with the submarine. They do seem to be now being fixed. That's not bad, given that this is the first class that we have produced in this country. It is the most complex artefact ever produced in this country, at a greater cost than the Snowy Mountains scheme, and with higher levels of skill than have ever been demanded by Australian industry, which produced 30 times world best practice welding, the best steel anywhere in the world that has gone into the hull of a conventional submarine, and the ship's management system, which is the integration of sonars navigation. The kids who produced the lines of code for that wrote twice the lines of code in the US space shuttle. We now have a submarine which in exercises with the Americans sank three aircraft carriers before it went under itself, which is a pretty good ratio, I would have thought, in exchange, if you look at war as an economic exchange. So and we also know this: six submarines are not enough for the Australian environment. You actually need more than that. If you look at the points of ingress and egress to Australian immediate waterways that you'd want to effectively patrol. But I would put the qualification, while therefore saying that I still have a view that we need more submarines, I do put the qualification on it, that you want to be certain before you go down that road that you've got all the teething problems associated with the submarine fixed before you do that. That seems to be the government's view on a seventh, and I don't think that that's an unintelligent approach.
Okay, thank you very much, Kim Beazley. I meant to tell you over lunch, Kim, that the oldest bottle of wine that I've ever drunk was a bottle of Madeira from the vintage of 1865, which of course is the last year of the American Civil War. I can't present you the nominal of those, I'm afraid. But for those of you who want to see more Kim Beazley, or hear more Kim Beazley at least, I believe he's on the Philip Satchel program on ABC Radio tomorrow morning talking about the Civil War, one of his pet interests. So thank you very much for coming along here today. We'd like to present you with this, another magnum of Orlando St Hugo Coonawarra Cabernet, which I hope will grace your cellar in Perth. And thank you again, and I'd like you to join me in thanking our guest speaker, Kim Beazley.